There is a lot of questions as to what happened, but eventually the government appointed a committee that investigated, the Warren Commission, and they held that Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone gunman who was then immediately shot down by a man who was associated with the mafioso, a man named Jack Ruby. But we were supposed to accept what the government told us. That's the way it happened. And then about 5 years later, four and a half years later, why, the president's brother, Senator Robert Kennedy, was speaking at a hotel in Los Angeles, and as he was leaving the hotel, going out through the kitchen, why, he himself was shot down and killed, and of course there was a man there named Saran, and he had a gun, and he was, of course, captured and sentenced and sent to prison. It was an open and shut case. But the question is it really an open and shut case? Well, we're fortunate to have with us Mr. Robert Joling and Philip Benfrag, who've been investigating this for a long time. I think Mr. Joling's been investigating it for well over 40 years. And, well, Mr. Benfrag has come up with some amazing technology that's allowed them to determine the number of shots that were fired. So, first of all, Mr. Joling, thank you so very much for being with us. Are you there?
Welcome that.
All right, fine. And then, Mr. Van Prague, are you there?
Yes, I am.
All right, fine. Well, why don't we just start off with the part that you played this. Why don't you tell us a little bit about this technology? Certainly we're told, of course, that Saran was there. He had a gun with eight shots in it, and he fired all eight shots. But is that the whole of the story? And what motivated you to really want to find out what really happened?
Well, it's rather ironic, I guess, that with all of the coverage that was provided for Robert Kennedy that night at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles, that there were many different media sources there covering the event, and yet none of them recorded the actual gunshots in that kitchen pantry. Except for a journalist, an independent journalist by the name of Stanislaw Brzezinski, who inadvertently had left his cassette recorder in the record position as he went to catch up to the Kennedy entourage, as that entourage was passing from the embassy room where Kennedy had given his victory statement over to the colonial room where he was to meet with the press. And in order to get from the one meeting room to the other, they were to pass through a narrow kitchen pantry area, and it was while they were passing through that area that the shots took place. I first became aware of the recording from an American journalist by the name of Brad Johnson, who's a senior news writer at CNN International in Atlanta. He became aware of the recording, uncovered it in May, I believe, of 2004, and got me involved in it in 2005, and I've been investigating it ever since.
Hold that thought. We're going to have to go to a quick break here, and we'll be back in just a moment. Well, our guest is Mr. Philip Van Prague. He's going to be telling us about his investigation of this recording that was actually recorded there in the kitchen there at the Ambassador Hotel on the night that Senator Kennedy was killed. So go ahead with the story.
Okay. In 2005, I was given permission by the California State Archives to make some high-quality digital copies of the Brzezinski recording copy that they had held for a number of years. And this was a recording copy that was turned over by the LAPD along with many thousands of documents and other recordings and photographs and whatnot to the State Archives there in Sacramento. And originally, Brzezinski's recording was made known to the FBI in late 1968, beginning in 1969, and Brzezinski at that time was living in Montreal, Canada, and so the FBI had the Royal Canadian Mounted Police interview Mr. Pruszynski and make a copy of Pruszynski's recording. And that copy was sent to the FBI laboratory in Washington, D.C. And at the FBI labs, they analyzed the recording, decided that at the time, of course, this was back in 69, where they didn't have all of the sophisticated techniques that they have today, but at that time, the FBI determined that the recording was not of a significant value. But nonetheless, they made two copies of that recording and sent those copies along with their source tape to their field office in Los Angeles. And one of those two copies made its way to the LAPD and then eventually was turned over to the California State Archives. So in first listening to that recording, I didn't think a whole lot of it either. It is certainly a poor quality recording. And yet, it did contain, it does contain, audible sounds that conform to shot sounds, that is, gunshots. And it was then through the subsequent analysis of that recording over the past 3 years that I made a number of discoveries, and the three discoveries, actually. The first discovery was that of 13 shot sounds over a little bit over a 5-second period of time. Now, the Pruszynski recording had to be retimed. That is, I retimed it to actually an NBC television broadcast.
Hold that thought. Hold that thought. We're going to bring our stations back on board right now. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Philip Van Prague comes from an engineering background, and he was able to get a copy of a tape that was recorded there in the kitchen there as the senator was being shot. And, of course, this had really not been analyzed, been looked at by the FBI. They didn't think it was much significance. But fortunately, there's a great deal of technology that has happened since 1968, and as a result of that, Mr. Van Prague was then able to amplify the tape, and he was actually able to hear 13 shots. Now, of course, what's significant about that is that Saran Saran's gun only had 8 bullets in it. So you pick the story up there, please.
Yes, actually it's much more than just being able to listen to the shot sounds. Certainly some of them are discernible by the human ear, but it really requires a great deal of electronic and computer analysis beyond that point, certainly to bring out those three discoveries. My second point I would wish to make is that while the exact number of gunshots I discerned 13 shot sounds over that period of time. The actual number of shots could have been 14, for example. The exact number is not that important once you get beyond 8. In other words, as you mentioned, the capacity of Sirhan's Ivor Johnson Cadet 55 22 caliber revolver was 8 shots, and indeed the police recovered 8 extended shell casings from that revolver. Once you get beyond 8 shots, then there had to have been another gun involved in that shooting.
And the other thing you'd commented that 8 shots of these shots that you could make out certainly had all been fired within about 5 seconds. So here we're talking about 13 shots in 5 seconds. That's pretty hard to do with one gun.
Well, actually, that led to my second discovery, and that is that throughout the course of these 13 shot sounds, there are two instances of what I call double shots, and that is two shots that occurred so closely together as to seemingly preclude the possibility of having come from a single weapon. And indeed, last year, the Discovery Times Channel folks, in preparation for putting together a documentary that they did that included my findings, had a gun expert in California do a rapid fire test of that same make and model of revolver. The fastest two-shot sequence that he was able to fire was, I believe, 366 milliseconds apart. And whereas on the Pruszynski recording, there are two double-shot sequences, one of which, shots 7 and 8, are about 122 milliseconds apart. So about three times as fast as what this famous firearms expert was able to achieve under optimum conditions. Whereas in the kitchen pantry when the shooting was going on, by the time the seventh and eighth shots were fired, Sirhan Sirhan was in a headlock by the assistant maitre d', Carl Euchre, and his gun hand was wrist was pinned down on a steam table. That was hardly what one would consider to be ideal shooting conditions. So that second discovery, again, precludes the possibility of there having been only one gun firing in that kitchen pantry. This continued research that I was doing eventually led to a third discovery, and that was while I was in the process of validating the first two discoveries and looking much closer at the shot sounds, I started to look at the frequency content of each of those shots. And what I found is that across those 13 shot sounds, the frequency content, using a technique that I call a frequency slice method, where I look at very, very narrow bands of frequencies and then overlay them upon each other to be able to compare shot to shot and also to the overall waveform. What I found was a common frequency signature throughout those 13 shot sounds, except that I found a frequency anomaly. In other words, at one particular frequency, at 1600 hertz, I found that five of the shot sounds presented with a much louder sound than did the other shot sounds. And when comparing from shot to shot and to the overall, it seemed to reverse what we were seeing with the other shot sounds. And those particular five shot sounds, it turns out that two of the five are contained within the double shots. In other words, each double shot contains one instance, that is one shot, that has this particular anomaly. And that further validates the double shots as coming from two different weapons, in addition to, as I mentioned earlier, the fact that they appeared too closely together to have possibly been fired from the Ivor Johnson. So the difficult part of that third discovery was trying to determine what the source of that anomaly could possibly be, and looked at a number of different things: the acoustics in the kitchen pantry, the dimensions of the room, the characteristics of the tape recorder that Brzezinski had used. We also had documentation from the FBI that indicated the recorders that they had used in their laboratory in Washington, D.C., which were recorders that I had worked with quite a bit in the past. So we looked at all of those things, but the bottom line kept coming back to that if any of those influences had caused this frequency anomaly, it should have presented itself for all of the shot sounds, since they all occurred over the same very short span of time. And the guns, we know, remained in pretty much the same position within the kitchen pantry during that sequence. So we were at a loss to try to determine what the source of that frequency anomaly could possibly be. So for lack of anything better, it was decided to conduct a firing range test. And we did this using two different models of .22 revolver. One of the models was an Ivor Johnson Cadet 55, the same model that Sirhan used in that kitchen pantry. The second model was a Harrington and Richardson 922, and this is a very interesting weapon. This particular .22 caliber revolver has the same rifling characteristics as the Ivor Johnson Cadet 55, and perhaps Dr. Joling in a bit can discuss why that is so important in this case. Secondly, this particular model happened to be owned by the security guard who was stationed immediately behind and slightly to the right of Robert Kennedy at the time of the shooting. Now, that is significant by virtue of the autopsy findings, and again, Dr. Joling can elaborate quite a bit on that in terms of what Dr. Noguchi found and how that places the second gun relative to Robert Kennedy at the time of the shooting.
Well, let me just see that Robert Noguchi, Dr. Noguchi, was the gentleman who did the autopsy, he was a coroner of Los Angeles at the time, internationally known for many of his other fascinating cases, but this was probably one of the most important of the autopsies that he did because, well, certainly, Mr. Joling, let's quickly cover what you had. You ever actually talked to Dr. Noguchi, or certainly you've seen his autopsy?
Yes, many times.
Well, what basically, why was this significant? What did he find that was different than the...
Because of the fact that each of the bullets that entered the Senator Kennedy's body came from the rear end to the right and went up at the steep angles upward. Three of the bullets struck his body, and one went through the top seam of his right side of his coat. In addition to that, two other bullets hit two victims called Goldstein and Wiesel. And the bullet that went into Dr. Noguchi's head entered his skull about a quarter of an inch away from the skull and about an inch or between an inch and 3 inches from the rear of the right ear lobe. That particular bullet could never be subjected to any type of a comparison because it was so mutilated and it broke into two parts when it entered his brain. However, the bullet that lodged in his neck at C6, called Exhibit 47, was sufficiently good enough to be subjected to a microscopic comparison with the two bullets that came out of Wiesel and Goldstein, and it was found that those three bullets had emanated from the same weapon, so that the four bullets that went into Senator Kennedy and the two that went into Wiesel and Goldstein, all six of those bullets came from the same gun, which was in a position to the rear and right of Senator Kennedy.
But of course, what about the Saran's bullets? What did they look like? Were they compared with the other bullets?
Yes, Saran's bullets were attempted to be compared to the other bullets, and unfortunately, when the special panel that had been appointed by Judge Winkie in 1975, seven expert forensic science firearms experts, they found that all of the alleged test-fired bullets could not be matched to the Sirhan gun, nor could any of the victim bullets be matched to the Sirhan gun. And interestingly, the three bullets that were able to be compared to others were the three from Kennedy's neck, Wiesel's belly, and Goldstein's buttocks. None of the other bullets were of sufficient good characteristics to be compared with anything. And therefore, the only thing that you could conclude was that there is no evidence that any of these bullets came from Sirhan's gun, although we know that he had to fire 8 shots because he had a revolver with 8 empty shell casings, and people saw him firing his gun at that night in the direction of the entourage of Senator Kennedy.
Well, I think the most important thing, though, is that Saran was standing in front of the senator. Of course, the bullet that killed him came from behind, hit behind his right
ear. That's absolutely correct.
And so we're going to be back here in just a moment. How could Saran, standing in front of Senator Kennedy, shoot him from behind? Well, of course, logic would tell you that it couldn't have happened. So we're told it was an open and shut case. Saran did it. He's in prison. He'd probably be there the rest of his life. He didn't remember what happened that evening. He remembers that, some things had happened beforehand, but he doesn't, this day, insists he doesn't remember shooting Senator Kennedy. We're going to be back in just a moment to try to solve what could possibly have happened. Well, Philip, why don't you pick up the story there? Because I think that was the important thing that we listeners needed to know, and that was the fact that suddenly the bullets came from behind, the ones that killed the senator. Saran is standing in front. He has a gun with 8 bullets in it. All were fired. But somebody else apparently fired at least another 5 bullets, 3 of them hitting the senator and 2 others hitting 2 other people. So basically, where do we go from there? As you analyze the sound, and of course, you're using very, very sophisticated technology to do that. Would that be correct?
Yes, absolutely. I think it's quite instructive to look at the sequence of the shots. Again, looking toward the 5 that displayed this particular anomaly and therefore can be attributed to the second gun, the first 2 shots did not display this anomaly and therefore most likely came from Sirhan's gun. And that coincides with the testimony of a number of people Goldstein, for example, who was one of the victims in the pantry, and the assistant maitre d', Carl Eucher, who had stated that Sirhan's gun, which was right in front of his face, basically, fired two shots, at which time then the maitre d' grabbed Sirhan's gun wrist, slammed it down on the table, the seam table, which probably attributed or caused the second and a half or second and a third delay between that second shot and then the remaining shots. And sure enough, on the Brzezinski recording, there is a delay after the first two shots. The third shot, we believe, since as it does display with this anomaly, came from the second gun. And so from that point on, then, we have an exchange between these two guns until the last of the shot sounds that we're able to discern, the 13th. As I mentioned before, both of the double shots each have one of these anomaly shots in it, which would stand to reason with regard to their not being, not having been possible to have been fired from Sirhan's weapon.
Well, now, why wasn't this information brought out, Sidney, at the trial? Of course, was as far as the sound was concerned, but didn't they actually find these bullets? Didn't anybody count the bullets there? And certainly, I would think that the defense counsel would have certainly made a point of what the autopsy showed, which showed that Sirhan, although he was there, certainly couldn't have killed Senator Kennedy. Was any of this brought out at the trial?
Well, you've got to remember that at that particular time, first of all, as Phil has already said, it was not the instrumentation sophisticated enough to do what he has done. However, on the other, you have to understand that what happened here was that people saw Sirhan raise his gun and fire it twice, and then there was a pause, and then he fired again. And they became fixated by looking at him when he fired it. They were mesmerized by that particular thing that occurred. In the meantime, the person standing behind Senator Kennedy was also firing his gun, but he was firing it underneath his right armpit and the back of his ear and into his shoulder pad, in a position where no one but one person stated that they had seen that happen. That person was Donald Shulman, who said the guard pulled his gun, fired it three times, and hit the senator all three times. The LAPD investigators simply told him he was wrong, even though they had not been there when it happened. This is after the fact what he told them. And they just said, you're wrong, and they dismissed it. So they concluded automatically there's eight shells out of Sirhan's gun.
Hold that thought. Hold that thought. We'll be right there.
They forgot to take any other guns that were coming to exam.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Robert Joling was just saying that there was a gentleman who had actually been there who saw the man that was a guard standing behind to the right of Senator Kennedy pull his gun and fire three shots into Senator Kennedy. He told the FBI, and the FBI said that he didn't see what he saw. He thought he saw that, but it didn't occur that way. And, of course, it was an open and shut case. And have you ever talked to that gentleman who actually saw the guard fire at Senator
Yes,
Kennedy?
I have, and I want to correct you on one thing you said. It wasn't the FBI that told him he was wrong. It was the criminalist who was heading up the investigation for the Los Angeles Police Department, who got to the scene about 2 hours after it happened, and they did not rope off the scene. They did not confiscate any other guns. They only took they didn't have Sirhan's gun, in fact. They didn't get that for at least a couple hours after the shooting occurred, and they got that from Rayford Johnson, who had received it from Rosie Greer, who had taken it from Sirhan.
And so Rosie Greer apparently was there. He grabbed the gun hand. It was pinned down, but he was able to wrestle the gun away from Sirhan. Then he gave it to his friend, and of course, then there was really no custody of that gun until for, what, 3 or 4 hours before it was turned over to the police?
About 2 hours or more, yes.
All right, fine. So that certainly doesn't show that they were treating this, you know, as you ordinarily would treat a crime scene.
It was a followed-up crime scene, totally. Not only they did not confiscate the guns, they had people mop, well, they allowed people to mop up the blood that was on the floor, for example. So that evidence was taken away. And there are other things that were done later on. They had a gun that they used for test firing. They destroyed that gun. So you don't know whether or not they used the H1, H602 or Sirhan's gun, which was 5.3725, and so there's a mix-up on the guns, there's a mix-up on the bullets, and it's just a mess.
All right, fine. Well, Mr. Van Praag, Sidney, at this point, why you've got this idea, you've got these two different sounds of different frequencies. Obviously, they're it was pretty obvious that they were different guns, isn't it?
Well, it certainly defied explanation simply looking at the Brzezinski recording, and that's why we went out and conducted this independent firing range test using those two models that I mentioned earlier. And the results of those tests were that the H&R 922 presented with an identical frequency anomaly to that which was heard in the Brzezinski recording when measured behind the H&R 922, which would have been the position of Brzezinski's microphone relative to the second gun in the kitchen pantry, and approximately at that same distance. The Ivor Johnson Cadet 55, however, did not present with that anomaly, either from the front or the rear. And so that result was just a remarkable similarity to what we hear on the Brzezinski recording. And because of the other interesting characteristics of that H&R 922 that I mentioned earlier, the rifling characteristic and the ownership of that model at the time of the shooting, that is certainly something that I think has to be looked at quite closely.
I see. But has anybody really looked at that other than you and Mr. Joling?
Well, at this point, of course, we've been trying to get the word out. Dr. Joling and I have lectured before the AAFS earlier this year, the American Academy of Forensic Sciences, also at the Dr. Henry Lee Institute of Forensic Sciences, adjunct to the University of New Haven. Of course, we have our book that is becoming available. And so the word is getting out, but this is something, obviously, 40 years after the shooting took place.
But, of course, it is still vitally important that we find out what really happened. I mean, certainly, if Sirhan did not commit the crime, standing in front would be pretty hard for him to shoot the senator from behind. Why, of course, then we have to try to find out why the Los Angeles Police Force didn't investigate this, why the information, at least some of this, wasn't presented at trial or being used, of course, actually in some sort of appeal at this time. Until I heard Mr. Joling speaking there at the Coast to Coast program, George Norrie program, I had never heard, of course, this information coming out. And I think it's certainly very important what you and what Mr. Philip Van Praag and Robert Joling are doing to get the information out about this open and shut case. And it really wasn't an open and shut case. So did the coroner, Noguchi, and actually pointed out that the bullets that killed the senator had come from behind. He made this very, very clear, and yet that information was totally ignored. And I wonder how many people in the listening audience had heard this story before. We're going to be back in just a moment as we continue exploring so-called open and shut case. That's the title of the book that's recently been written, and I'm looking forward to getting a copy myself. Well, this is Dr. Stan. We have Philip Van Praag with us, and we're talking about certainly the background of the sounds now that seem to indicate and indicate very clearly that there were two guns being fired, at least 13 shots, maybe more, but at least 13 shots. And, of course, you can differentiate one shot of one gun from the shot of the other gun simply by the frequencies and looking at this. Do you actually look at this under an oscilloscope, or how do you actually look at that?
Well, the initial analyses were done using an oscilloscope in the traditional time domain, but then later we had to go to the frequency domain and using computer technology, which provided the level of specificity that we needed to get this frequency slice methodology firmly established. In other words, to be able to look much more closely at each, at the constituent elements, the various frequencies that made up each one of these shot sounds, and then be able to compare these against each other in a meaningful way. And you know, as I mentioned earlier, of course, back in the 60s, this technology was not available at all. And so the FBI laboratory, I guess, can slide a little bit on that one in terms of their conclusion that they didn't feel that the recording, certainly back then, would have been of great significance.
Well, this is rather unique technology. Have you developed this, or has this been developed elsewhere?
As far as I can tell, it hasn't been used elsewhere, which was a surprise to me. It was an evolutionary step in my analysis of the recording, and as I mentioned earlier, once I discovered this frequency anomaly in what otherwise was a very common signature of these 13 gunshot sounds, trying to explain how that possibly could have happened with only five of the shot sounds. Until I had gotten to that point, we had used more conventional technology, shall we say. Although it certainly goes far beyond the ability of the human ear to differentiate shot sounds. Now, the human ear, of course, is very sensitive, and when you listen to the Pruszynski recording, and if you are pointed to the particular portion of that recording over the 35 minutes or whatever that recording includes, to that particular interval in the kitchen pantry, the average person can differentiate some shot sounds.
Hold that thought for just a moment.
Sound like they could be gunshots.
Please hold that. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Philip von Prague and Robert Joling. And before we go on, I'd like you to tell our listeners about the book. If you have a website, and of course, is the book available now, or is it going to be released very soon? What's the situation with your book?
The book is described, of course, on our website. We do have a small number of copies available. These copies, most of them have been distributed to various members of medical and legal professions and law enforcement professions. And we had done this with the idea in mind of having these folks review the book and provide their comments on it. And I will say that we've been very gratified by the excellent response that we have received from the book. Some of those reviews, in fact, are contained on the website. There still are some copies available, and the instructions for ordering are also on the website, www.anopenandshutcase, all one word, .com.
That's www.anopenandshutcase.com, right?
That's correct.
All right, fine. And so, and then what will you find on the website? Somebody just go there. You have a lot of commentary on this? What would they find on the website?
There are some excerpts from the book. We have reproduced a few portions of it. There are reviews by some very distinguished individuals also contained on the website, as well as in the archive section we have excerpts from some of the media coverage that has been provided thus far, the most recent of which is an interview that we did for CNN International about a week or 2 weeks ago.
All right, fine. Well, now, when will the mass production of the book be available? In other words, are you going to put out another major edition of the book?
Well, we're in the process of finding a major publisher for the book. We do not have an announcement to make in that area at this time. But again, if they will go to the website, there are some copies available that can still be obtained.
All right, fine.
The initial printing.
All right, fine. Well, anyway, of course, we've been talking about the technology that's involved here, and although apparently the human ear could actually pick up the difference between the sounds, between the shots, why it's much better, of course, when done electronically and using computer technology. And then the difference between the shots is very, very obvious. In other words, you can hear the various shots. Some of them are double shots, two shots together, but there are different tones in each one, and it's amazing what we can do with computers today, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. Again, way back in the late 60s, it would not have been possible to do this type of analysis at this level of depth.
And, of course, as you've talked to these forensic groups, whether it be Dr. Lee's group or the other groups, what sort of response have you gotten from these people involved in forensic pathology and forensic studies? Certainly, they are quite supportive of your work?
They have been supportive, and we've received some very good reviews from the lectures that we've conducted thus far, and also again from copies of the book that have been distributed. So it's been very gratifying. But this third discovery in particular does involve a technology that methodology, I should say, that evidently has not been extensively used before. And so one of the appeals that we make in the lectures that we give is for further study of this. For example, other makes and models of guns could be tested for these resonances and cataloged as such, so that as other cases come up with recordings of gunshot sounds, perhaps this methodology could be of use in other cases as well in terms of determining the makes and models of guns that are involved, or excluding particular makes and models of guns that are involved in those shootings.
All right, Sydney. Now, what about the, is there a lawyer who is actually representing Saran? Saran, I know he's making appeals for parole. He's made these appeals every several years, and of course he's always turned down. Does he have any legal representation? I would think they would be fascinated by the material that you've come up with.
Yes, he's presently represented by an attorney. We have not yet sat down or communicated with him, although he has indicated a willingness or a desire to sit and speak with us. However, you have to realize that Phil and I did not write this book to exonerate Sirhan, even though we know that he did not shoot Senator Kennedy. He still assaulted people with a deadly weapon and did hit three people. And therefore, even though he's probably sitting in jail for the wrong offense, he's not going to be exonerated from doing some crime, and unless they can show that he was under the influence of some buddy or some one who controlled his thought processes at the time under, let's say, a hypnotic program. And if that were the case, his lawyer would have to, of course, bring that before a judge and jury to have that determined.
That's sort of a Manchurian candidate, is what you're suggesting.
That's a possibility, because there's a great evidence, a great amount of evidence, in fact, in this case, that Sirhan, at the time he was arrested, gave every indication that he was hypnoprogrammed. He had the calmness. He had the sweats when he came out of it. And he had no memory of doing it. So he had a post-hypnotic suggestion to overcome any knowledge he would have had of it, and he has always maintained he has no memory of it.
Well, it certainly is a very strange situation, but I think that certainly you, Mr. Van Praagh, have not tried to come up with an explanation of what happened, other than the fact that the story that we've heard just is not true. Would that be a fair estimate?
Yes, I think so. What we've done is actually started together a year ago when we first met to tell exactly what we know as far as the facts are concerned, not to hypothesize about things that we don't know about. We did nothing in the area of speculation. We did nothing in the area of of saying that this man was hypnoprogrammed. We didn't get into that. There are conspiracy theories, and although in our book we mention what they are, we do not pretend to say we know whether or not there was a conspiracy or whether there was not a conspiracy. We don't denigrate the action of people who go into those things, but that is not germane to the findings which Phil and I have made. We based our opinions and conclusions strictly on the physical facts and on the scientific hypotheses that we could prove.
And, of course, what you can prove is that bullets came from behind and Saran was standing in front. And of course, sometimes, you know, things have an appearance, but the appearances are not necessarily accurate. Well, Mr. Van Praagh, was there anything else as far as the acoustics and your analysis of the tape that we should be bringing out?
Well, I think that pretty well covers it. Certainly the conclusions from what my experiments have shown primarily is that there indeed was a second gun, and that second gun is proven by virtue of the number of shot sounds, and again, it can be argued whether the exact number is 13 or 14 or 15 or 12. Point is, it's greater than 8, and even one greater than 8 proves the presence of a second gun. Secondly, the presence of two instances of double shots, two shots fired too close together to have come from a single weapon, certainly not from a low-grade weapon such as Sirhan had at the time. And then third, the presence of this frequency anomaly that just happens to match the identical make and model as this Harrington and Richardson 922 that has the same rifling characteristics as the Ivor Johnson Cadet 55. And also was a model, make and model that was known to have been owned by one of the people in the pantry at the time of the shooting. So, again, as Dr. Joling quite accurately points out, we're not conspiracy theorists. The various conspiracy folks are free, obviously, to use or not use the data that we've come up with. Some of it certainly would tend to support a number of those various theories that are out there, but certainly from my findings, it's conclusive that there was a second gun, that the person who shot Robert Kennedy also shot at least two other victims, as we had heard also stated by Dr. Joling on the basis of the bullet matches that were made from victim bullets. So I think that that information, it's now up to the courts, up to the attorneys to take that information and use it as they will moving forward. We would certainly hope that a new investigation would be launched, and to the extent that they can utilize our findings, so much the better.
Well, now, because what about the bullets themselves? Certainly, there's a very, very real question about the number of slugs that were found, and certainly three in Senator Kennedy, and then there were two in other people. But certainly, did they find some of the other bullet fragments around the room?
They extracted a single bullet, at least, from every victim that was fired upon and hit.
Now, how many victims were there?
Five besides Senator Kennedy. So six people got hit.
Okay, fine.
They got five bullets out of the individuals, and they got three bullets out of Senator Kennedy. So that's eight bullets.
Right.
But then they had a couple other bullets that they could explain. And so that was some of the bullet holes they couldn't explain. Let me put it that way. The one that went through the senator's coat, for example, it went up into the ceiling tiles. They never found that bullet, apparently. And it became right there was a ninth shot because Senator Kennedy got hit four times, including the one in his clothing, and he had five other people, and five and four makes nine. You can't get nine shots out of an eight-shot revolver. So even if you just take the bullet count of those people, you get nine shots. Then if you take a bullet count of the bullet holes that are found in the center dividers and in the door jams and in the stage jam, you come up eventually where you've got 14 bullets you've got to account for at least.
Well, now, what about these bullets?
Out of an eight-shot revolver.
What about these bullets in the central divider? What is the central divider, and why is that significant?
When the Kennedy entourage entered the pantry area, there were two swinging doors, the one on the left, which they came through, which was on the north side of that entryway, was the open door. That's the one that the people came through. Between those two swinging doors, there was a center divider, and there were two bullet holes into that center divider, and there was two bullet holes in the left door jamb. And they were photographed by the LAPD and photographed by the FBI, and one of the exhibits, Exhibit E3, is found within the autopsy protocol as an exhibit. In addition to that, there's a photograph, an AP photograph, showing officers Wright and Rossi pointing to a bullet hole they found in the door jamb behind the stage. And they're shining their photograph, their flashlight at it. And later on, I was present when Vincent Bigliosi, the attorney who prosecuted the Manson tribe, took an affidavit from one of the officers who said, indeed, there was a bullet there. And the bullets in the center divider, FBI agent William Bailey gave us a statement saying that he and other FBI agents saw bullet holes in that door jamb. But the Los Angeles Police Department, through their clairvoyance and not being present when it happened, simply declared them out of existence and said there weren't any there. Yeah, we have photographs from individual photographers who took photographs of those areas, and you have the FBI photographs, we have the LAPD photographs, and yet the Los Angeles Police Department investigators in the criminalistic division just to declare them out of existence, and that's supposed to be the answer.
Well, of course, the thing is that they have the conclusion that there were only eight bullets fired, so we've already, of course, made provisions for nine of them. Why, of course, we can't find any more. That would even be more difficult to determine. Nobody actually tried to dig those bullets out of the divider or out of the door jamb.
Yes, the ones in the center divider were taken out, and the door jamb was removed, and the door jamb was taken to the LAPD criminalistic department, and it was x-rayed at that position. As were the ceiling tiles above the position of Sirhan, where bullet holes were located. And they just, later on, after they'd taken the x-rays and so forth, destroyed the ceiling tiles, destroyed the door jams and the wooden things they had, claiming that there was not room enough to store them. Never given the idea, I guess, to photograph them, cut them down to size, and put them in an envelope and store them in a drawer. Didn't need the entire 8-foot door jam panel. You could just, take a photograph of it and cut it down to size and put it in an envelope.
Well, you would think, with one of the major murders of the century, they might find enough space to actually keep these things for future evaluation.
Well, they're supposed to do that, but they destroyed them even before Sirhan's time of appeal went by.
Really, of course, you have a feeling that somebody was trying to keep the information from getting out. Now, of course, it could be gross incompetence, but it seems like an awful gross incompetence to destroy a potential evidence there. But there were actually, when they did the x-rays on the central divider, on the door jamb, did they find the evidence of the bullets there?
We don't know, because they never kept any records, and they destroyed anything that they had.
In other words,
they made any records, they never divulged them and never disclosed them.
And of course, then they destroyed the x-rays that they took?
Yes, they're not available.
Well, of course, when so many things happening, eventually you begin to get the feeling that maybe we're not getting the full story here. But anyway, this is a fascinating bit of history, and of course, you've been at this for how long, Mr. Joling?
39 and a half years.
And
you've February of 1969.
And you actually talked to Dr. Noguchi
many times.
Talked
to him as late as this past February.
Really? Well, Chris, is he still around? Is he still practicing, or is he retired?
Oh, he's not practicing anymore. Tom's in his late 70s, or early 70s anyway, I think. He's probably 73, 74 years old, somewhere up in there.
Well, he's just a young fellow.
I'm older than that, of course, you don't.
Hey, Biden. Anyway, of course, we're going to be back here in just a moment to wrap up the program, and then we're going to let Mr. Van Praagh go, because he's going to be with us just for this 1 hour. But when we get back, we'll see if there's any more information he wants to get out. We're talking about the assassination of Senator Edward Kennedy. What was the date of that?
June 5, 1968.
Well, I'm sorry, what was the date again?
June 5th, 1968.
So, I mean, here's one of the great events of the last century, and of course, a lot of the evidence was destroyed. You ask yourself, why? We'll be back in just a moment. Perhaps we can answer some more of those questions. Well, Dr. Stan here. Our guest is Dr. Robert Joling and Philip Van Praagh. Mr. Van Praagh, is there anything else that we should be covering as far as the work that you've done?
Well, I think we've pretty well covered the three discoveries and potentially the significance of it, and of course of greatest importance, the validation of the second gun, the presence of the second gun, in that kitchen pantry, as well as the likelihood of the make and model of that second gun.
And of anything, Chris, what the most significant thing about this is that certainly the people who certainly evaluated this case, knowing full well what the autopsy report showed, did not, of course, bring this out at the trial or question. This is not to say that Saran wasn't involved. It is to say that, you know, it's impossible to shoot somebody from behind when you're standing in front of them. And when this happens, it's amazing, of course, that this was not brought out at the trial. Why didn't Saran's attorney bring that one fact out that would have raised a sufficient question in the minds of people of the jury who heard the case? Do we know why the attorney, who was the defense attorney, did not mention that the bullets came from behind when Saran was standing in front?
Yes, Grant Cooper tried this case on a psychiatric defense, and it was not based upon physical evidence or on forensic sciences. And that is where he made his mistake. He believed everything the criminalist told him and accepted whatever he said as gospel, and what he should have done is had a firearms expert take a look at the weapons not only, but also at the entire crime scene. And he should have looked at the schematic drawings, and he should have made inquiry as to what guns were confiscated and looked at, who had guns, who drew guns, and he didn't do that. It was a very incompetent defense from that standpoint, but understandable when you understand he was trying to get Sirhan away from being penalized by a death penalty. But they did that anyway, and then the Supreme Court of course, said the California law was unconstitutional, and that's how he became a lifetime prisoner in California.
All right, fine. Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment as we explore more of this case. And, of course, it's really one of the great crimes of the last century. And it was for many of these crimes, there are serious questions as to what really happened. And looking back now over a span of well over 40 years, because we're talking about 40 years ago when the crime was committed, why, of course, we need, of course, to evaluate what happened and try to get to the truth, because I personally believe that no man's life or family are safe if these crimes really go unpunished. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan here. Mr. Van Praagh, I want to thank you so very much for being with us, and we really appreciate your being up here late and helping us.
Oh, thank you.
God bless, and we'll talk to you later, and I think
okay.
Mr. Van Praagh is on line one, so we're going to let him go, and Dr. Joling's kind enough to agree to be with us the second hour when we will actually open our lines for questions from the audience. But this is the time when I need to remind our listeners out across America that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported. And if you're listening to this program and you believe, as I do, that we're involved in a spiritual battle that's being played out in a political, ideological, cultural, financial, economic battlefield, why, we do hope that many of you give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. And I know that so many people out there are having real financial problems, and we understand that. But if you are in a position to help, again, our number 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, we certainly hope that many of you will want to take a second look at the assassination of John Kennedy. And, of course, we have a couple of 4-tape sets we put together on that. We actually have an excellent DVD put out by our good friend Bob Fletcher, frequent guest here on the program. But he's gone into the assassination of John Kennedy, and I think you'd really enjoy his DVD. They're very well done. And then we carry a book on that. A Sniper Looks at Dealey Plaza. That's A Sniper Looks at Dealey Plaza, written by Lieutenant Colonel Craig Roberts. And of course, pointing out the fact that there is no way at all, no way at all that Lee Harvey Oswald could have gotten those three shots out. And in the time, if I think it was about 5 seconds he was allowed. And then of course, the book Elite Serial Killers by our good friend Galen Ross. Dealing with the assassinations not only of John Kennedy but of his brother and then of Martin Luther King and even of Abraham Lincoln. Fascinating insight into what's going on and what has gone on in history. So all of these items are available, and we're talking about the book A Sniper Licks at Dealey Plaza by Lieutenant Colonel Craig Roberts, Elite Serial Killers, the DVD on the Kennedy assassination by Bob Fletcher, and, of course, our four tape sets. And, well, actually, you'll hear there my interview with Lyndon Johnson's mistress, Madeline Duncan Brown, as she talks about the meeting that was held the night before. She was there. She didn't attend the meeting, but when, of course, Lyndon Johnson came out of the meeting, with, of course, many of the key people in government, people like J. Edgar Hoover and, of course, Richard Nixon was there, and, of course, Lyndon Johnson. But Lyndon Johnson said, to his mistress, well, after tomorrow, won't have to worry about them Kennedy boys. And, of course, people were there from the CIA and from the Mafia, and a very, very select group. The people who have been there have been verified by a number of people. But you probably never heard of it. You'll actually hear my interview, two-hour interview, with Madeline Duncan Brown there in our second four tape set called the JFK Assassination Update. So anyway, if you're interested in getting this material, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, we do hope you'll go to our website. It's radioliberty.com. And if you have a computer, you can listen there to our programs 9 hours a day, and you won't get anything accomplished. But that, of course, is the live feed that goes to the satellite. A lot of the programs are repeated. But you'll also hear our good friend Joyce Riley. You'll hear our good friend Pastor Chuck Kressmeyer and Butch Palm. So they're all there, of course, on our 24-hour feed. If you're interested in getting a satellite, we can put you in touch with the people who do that. If you're interested in getting a Wi-Fi radio, and if you have Wi-Fi in your home, you can get an excellent radio, which we do make available through Radio Liberty. And if you just give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, that's 1-800-544-8927. We'll call you back and tell you about the Wi-Fi radios. They are really are amazing because you can pick up any internet programming in any place. And, of course, they're portable radios. They're made overseas, not available yet here in America. And I think this is the finest one that's out there. Anyway, we have one. We enjoy it ourselves. So if you're interested in the Wi-Fi radio, satellite, anyway, we'll be back in a moment to wrap up this program. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and of course, for the next hour, they're going to be those of Dr. Robert Joling, as we explore much more of the background of the of this strange murder of Senator Robert Kennedy, the brother of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, President Kennedy. And certainly this occurred back there in 1968, in June of 1968, and Mr. Joling has been following this, and only recently has they put together a book. It's called An Open and Shut Case. It's an open and shut case where some minutes of the material will be laid out. Mr. Joling, has anybody talked to the guard, the man who was standing just behind to the right of Senator Kennedy, and who was actually, at least one of the observers had said, had actually pulled his gun and shot Senator Kennedy from behind? Has anybody talked to him? Whatever happened?
Yes, the Los Angeles Police Department took a statement from him in July of 1968, Officer Steen is the officer who took the statement. And then subsequent to that, several of the authors who have written on this subject have talked with the guard. Dan Maldea, for example, is one of them. And he's an investigative journalist that talked to him. And so he has been talked to. He has given statements. We do have some of those written statements in our possession, and we do talk about them in our book.
All right, fine. Of course, what happened to his gun? Because I think that's probably one of the most interesting things. And, of course, tracking that gun down, the gun that the guard had, is a really important part of this whole story. Of course, didn't he say that he'd sold the gun before the shooting? Or what's the background?
A very interesting story about that gun. When he was first questioned about whether or not he owned a .22 caliber gun, he said yes, but he said he carried a .38 on the night of the incident. And when he was asked about the .22 he owned, he said he had sold that gun 3 months before the assassination. However, subsequently, Theodore Chirac, who was an investigative journalist, found out that that was not true, and that the guard had actually sold that gun to a man by the name of Jim Yoder in Arkansas 3 months to the day after the assassination. And so Teddy contacted Mr. Yoder, as did others. And Mr. Yoder said, yes, I bought a gun from this guard, and I paid him $15 for it. And in our book, you'll find a receipt showing that that indeed did occur. And it happened on September 6, 1968, not 3 months before the assassination. After that gun was in the hands of Yoder, however, he had his home, he lived in Arkansas at the time, he had his home burglarized by some young lads, and he lost possession of the gun. As a result of that, somebody put up the money, and they drained the pond within which that gun had been thrown. And they found the gun, and indeed the gun they took out of the pond bore the serial number that was shown on the receipt that Teddy Chirac had received from Jim Yoder.
So now, how did it get in the pond? Did the boys who stole it?
The boys stole it in the, in the pond when they were under investigation, and they knew the police officers were after him.
All right.
The gendarme was after them. And so they got rid of the gun by throwing it into the pond. And when they were arrested, they told that story, and so they had the pond drained, got the gun, and indeed it did bear that serial number.
All right. Now, what about the rifling in that? Was it too rusty?
All right, now it's interesting about that. We happened to know. Now, we didn't know this back in 1968, we didn't know it in 1975, we didn't find out about it until the 1980s. We were questioning whether or not there was the same rifling characteristics on the gun of Sirhan and the gun that this guard had. Now,
hold that thought, 0.054 inches
of the rifling. The reason that's important is because when you look at the familial characteristics of a gun, in other words, how long is it, what caliber it is, how many twists to the barrel, the right twist, left twist to the grooves and lands, and these types of things, and then you get to the individual characteristics. When a bullet goes down the barrel of a gun, for example, the explosion of the powder squeezes that bullet into the chamber of the barrel and out with force. As it goes down that barrel, these particular bullets that were involved in this particular case were covered with an alloy, and that was to fill in the gaps in the lands and grooves that goes down and keep it true in its course. And that, of course, fills up, and they get the bullets, they put them in a microscope, as a comparison microscope. They put a test bullet on one side and a victim bullet on the other side, and you look at these two bullets through the comparison microscope to see whether or not they're identifiable striae or markings that look exactly alike from one bullet to another. If they do, they know they came out of the same barrel, because when the gun is manufactured, there are certain defects that are automatically imprinted inside the barrel of the gun, which are left upon the lead bullet as it goes through the barrel. And by making this comparison, they can say, oh, they've got the same striations, therefore we know that they are the same bullet. They have the same lands and grooves, they have the same width of the rifling, that came from that gun. Well, in this case, we've got two guns that have the same rifling, 0.054 inches. So that particular differential would not be important in this case, other than to say that you cannot say that the gun of Sirhan or the gun of the guard, in this instance, fired one or the other bullet. They both have the same rifling angle, so that can't be in here. But that is how that's done. They make the comparison through a comparison microscope and look at the striations, the markings that are left by the imperfections in the barrel.
It was my understanding that actually people who actually tried to identify the bullets, that were in a couple of the victims, as coming from Sirhan's gun, they couldn't verify that. Is that true?
That's true, but that is not too surprising to those of us who are in forensic sciences because of this fact. 22 caliber bullets are noted for being very difficult to make a comparison identification. And that is because of approximately 70-80% of the bullets that are compared one to another cannot be identified as coming from the same gun. So you get about a 20-30% chance of making a match even under the best circumstances.
Hold that thought for just a moment here as we bring our stations on board. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest is Robert Scholling, and of course, Robert's been researching this for 40 years. They were actually able to track down the gun that the guard had. He had sold it to somebody else, and then he'd sold it to somebody else, or I guess he had actually had the gun stolen from them by some youthful criminals who eventually threw it into a pond, and they actually were able to get the pond drained and get the gun, and it had the same serial number on it. They knew it was, of course, the guard's gun. But that is actually, where is that gun at the present time, do we know?
Well, I think I know, but I'm not at liberty to say exactly
What is it, in the hands of the legal authorities or private authorities?
Most likely.
All right, fine. Well, we won't try to pin you down on that. But anyway, of course, as you've gone through this story, and certainly I'm surprised that Dr. Gucci didn't come out and make some public statements about the fact that the bullets came from behind where Sirhan was standing in front. Didn't he feel rather frustrated that his autopsy report...
Well, he did make those statements, and now he put it right in his autopsy protocol.
Right, but of course, the public never understood that.
No, but then on the other hand, when the grand jury was convened, which was on the 7th day of June, just day after he died, Tom Noguchi was asked by one of the assistant district attorneys whether or not he wanted to change his answer. And he said, no, the facts are there. I have no reason to do that. Just tell the truth. And it was dropped. They never again, at any time, either before the grand jury or at the trial, asked Tom Noguchi anything about that particular matter, either by the prosecution or by the defense. And, of course, at a trial, you just can't volunteer. You just answer the questions that you're asked. In addition to that, Tom Noguchi was under fire at that time by people in the hierarchy who wanted to get rid of him. And as a result of that, that's one of the reasons, I am sure, that I was called to the suite of Bill Deckard and him on February 1969 to look at the autopsy protocol and see whether there was something that was wrong with it or what was wrong with this, you know.
Well, why don't you give us a little background? How did you then get involved? Somebody asked you to look at the autopsy report?
I was president-elect at that time of the American Academy of Forensic Sciences. The following year, I became president. And I had been in forensic sciences for quite some time at that point as a user, as a lawyer. And I was a friend of Dr. William Eckert and a Dr. Thomas DeGucci. I knew them both very well. And at the annual meeting of the American Academy of Forensic Sciences in February of 1969 at the Drake Hotel in Chicago, Bill Eckert called me up and said, "Bob, you come down to my room. I want to discuss some things with you." And I said, "Sure." And I went down to his room, and Tom was there and some other people. And I was asked if I would be kind enough to read the autopsy protocol. And I said, "Sure." And I did, and it took me the better part of a couple hours to read it and talk about it and go through it. And then we had a long discussion for a long period of time about what could be done, what examinations could be forthcoming, and how would we go about it, and what about neutron activation analysis, what about psychiatric examinations, what about polygraph examinations, and what about a lot of things of this nature, firearms examinations. And we went through all this stuff, and whenever we got onto anything that was political, Tom would become very quiet, and I understood why, because he was under the gun. Well, then, Godfrey Isaac was his attorney. Godfrey Isaac's a lawyer in Los Angeles, and this matter came up before the Board of Supervisors, and it was found out that sometime along the line there, the person who had brought the charges against Dr. Noguchi at the time was not a medical doctor, as he claimed to be. He had falsified his credentials and had taken the name and license of a Chicago lawyer, I think back in 1916, 17, or 18, somewhere back in there. And when this was found out, then this alleged Dr. Stewart was roundly criticized, and the charges against Tom Noguchi, of course, were dismissed because they were false. And he remained as the coroner, as he should have. The autopsy protocol, which Dr. Noguchi wrote, was probably the best autopsy protocol I have ever read before, since, or during. He just did a tremendous job, and it's very clear when you read it what happened. And there's no question in my mind that Senator Kennedy was shot from behind, from the right, and that the bullet that entered his brain was fired within one quarter of an inch of his skull and 1 to 3 inches behind the right earlobe. That was the fatal shot. There's no question in my mind that two other bullets were shot. One went under his armpit and ended up at C6 of the cervical spine. The other one was also shot from underneath his armpit and came out the front of his chest and went to the ceiling tiles above and behind Sirhan. And another bullet went through the top of his suit coat, and that also ended up in the tiles above and behind Sirhan. So there's no question in my mind what happened to these things. But the Los Angeles Police Department could not reconcile this with the thought that they had that there were only 8 shell casings that were empty in Sirhan's gun, and therefore only 8 shots were fired. But they never confiscated any other gun that was in that room that night. The Jack Merritt, one of the guards, had drawn his gun. Plain Eugene Cesar not only had drawn his gun, but he admitted drawing his gun, and people said he had drawn his gun, and they saw him fire it, and they just simply dismissed it. When they did schematic drawings of how the bullets were fired by Sirhan, you look at it, and they moved the whole project, all the bodies down to be put into a position that met their predetermination. And in fact, they have one bullet going up into the ceiling and coming down from the ceiling, entering the head of Elizabeth Evans in a downward direction. Where if you look at the medical record of Elizabeth Evans, you will find that bullet traversed into her skull going upward. You cannot get a ricochet bullet off the ceiling going upward into somebody's skull. Therefore, that bullet had to come off the floor into her head, and she had her posterior portion of her anatomy pointed towards Sirhan because the bullet went up into her forehead in a fashion that indicated that she was in that direction as she said she was while she was looking for a shoe. So those are the types of things that they were doing, and it just did not add up. And we are definitely convinced that Sirhan did not shoot Kennedy, nor could he have done so.
Well, of course, the question is then, why wouldn't the Los Angeles Police Department evaluate all of the evidence? Why would they manipulate the evidence to fit into their preconceived notion? They're supposed to be looking for the truth and not trying to justify their idea of what happened.
That's what you would imagine happened, and that's what I would think would happen. That's what I did think would happen initially. But as William Harper, the criminalist and firearms examiner from Pasadena, California, said at the time, Wolfer, who was the criminalist from the LAPD, wasn't very good at veracity, let alone competency. And that was a statement of Harper. He coined the word Wolferism, meaning that the person not only was incompetent, but he gave the boss what the boss wanted without regard to veracity. And then the Supreme Court of California, in the Kursky case, which was decided in, I think it was in September of 1969, stated of Wolfer that he was, that he had given testimony that bordered on the perjurious and that he had falsified his credentials. This is the man who was giving the testimony to the court and jury in the Sirhan case. And so you look at it and you say, well, now I sort of understand why this is so convoluted and so so irrational when you get to it. You say, how many mistakes can a man make in one case, you know? And that's what happened in this situation.
Well, really, of course, it's tragic because, of course, it would be important to understand what happened and why it happened and why the information was not certainly brought out. Now, of course, as far as the other gun was concerned, that gun, fortunately, now is at least in somebody's hand. This is a gun that was had by the guard. And is the guard is still living in Los Angeles, or where is he now?
Well, the guard's now over in the Philippines. He divorced his first wife, is remarried and living in the Philippines. But with regard to that gun, let me caution a bit, just a moment here. Even if they take that gun and they examine it and they make a comparative analysis between the bullets test fired with that gun and the known victim bullets that are capable of being examined and compared, that would be the Kennedy bullet, the Wiesel and Goldstein bullets, it doesn't mean that if they get no match that that gun wasn't involved, because as I said before, 70-80% of the time you would not get a match using a 22 caliber bullets in a crime scene.
But, of course, you would have a 20% chance of finding it. If you did find it, it would certainly change everything, wouldn't it?
That would be a real coup if that would happen.
All right.
Real coup.
Well, let's hope, of course, that the information comes out one way or the other. Now, certainly, there must have been a number of other people. Did anybody talk to Rosie Greer, who was there? Rosie Greer has always impressed me as being a fairly straightforward fellow, as, you know, big husky football player, was there as a special guard for Bobby Kennedy, and he was the one who wrestled the gun away from Sirhan. Were, of course, all these people focusing on Sirhan, or is anybody else looking around, other than the one person who said he saw the guard shoot from behind?
Yeah, you have to remember that Rosie Greer and Rafer Johnson were not in the pantry when the shooting started.
Oh, they weren't, huh?
They were in the hallway back where Ethel was coming off that stage, and they were sort of assisting her. And then when the firing started, they ran into the pantry. They came over where the meaty was, and they, at that point of time already, Sirhan had been placed upon the steam table by Carl Euchre, and Ed Manasian, who was another maitre d', had grabbed the legs of Sirhan, and Sirhan kept on firing his gun. And then when Rafer Johnson and Rosie Greer got there, Rosie wrested the gun away from Sirhan and gave it to Rafer Johnson, who put it into his pocket, where it remained for the next couple of hours. He took it down to Parker Station and delivered it. That was the first time the LAPD ever got a hold of that gun.
Well, you know, there are a lot of strange things about this. One of the, of course, is the stories of Sirhan. Sirhan, we hear that, you know, one of the first things he did when he got into prison was ask for a copy of Madame Blavatsky's The Secret Doctrine. And some people say he was deeply involved in studying the occult. Had you heard any of those stories?
Yeah, he was very much involved in the Rosicrucians and in the occult, self-hypnosis and that type of thing.
So he was actually involved with the Rosicrucian movement?
Yes. Well, he attended the meetings. Whether he was one or what, I don't know. But, I mean, it's known that he did attend them and he did books on it and so forth.
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess, of course, this is Mr. Robert Ticholing. We're talking about Saran Saran. Of course, he says that he doesn't remember that. What does actually Saran Saran say about his explanation of what happened?
I have never personally spoken to Saran, and for a particular reason. I have had two opportunities where I could have pressed and probably most likely could have been there to talk with him. First of all, I did not want to be prejudiced by his statements to me, which might have been self-serving, and I didn't want to get into that. Secondly, I did speak with his mother at a great length, and she had come to see me, and Mary told me that her son had no memory of the event, which is something I would expect if somebody was in a post-hypnotic suggestion not to remember, and it is possible that that could happen. In fact, I talked to Dr. Herbert Spiegel just late, Phil and I both did, as late as November of last year concerning this matter, and I had talked to him previously about this matter, and he is convinced that Sirhan was a hypnoprogram, as were some of the other psychiatrists with whom I have spoken. Dr. Simpson, who treated Sirhan for a while after he was in prison, and there were other, Dr. Pollock and Dr. Diamond, both of those people had worked with Sirhan during the trial, and both of them had hypnotized him. Both of them said that he was very susceptible to suggestions and could be hypnotized with a snap of the finger. And so it wasn't surprising to me when he or others claimed that he may have been hypnoprogrammed. But, again, who knows? And that's, again, getting into a conspiracy theory, and it's not germane to the findings of Phil and myself, and so we just really don't adhere to either one of those theories. We just say, okay, he's hypnotizable, but the facts show that there were at least 14 bullets fired that night. You can't get 14 shots out of an HL revolver. I don't care where you're at.
No, I don't think, and Chris, I think we get so many details sometimes. You get lost in the details. It's simply, all you have to do is say there are 14 shots. You don't get that from a 8-shot revolver or 8-shot pistol, and you certainly don't get bullet wounds in the back when you're standing in front. So those two things alone, without any of the other considerations, should send the raise.
Yeah, you know, Doctor, frequently when I give lectures on this, I speak about don't overlook the obvious.
Right.
And if you've got 9 bullets coming out of an 8-shot revolver, you've got a problem. If you've got 14 shots coming out of an HR revolver, you've got a bigger problem.
Right.
And if you've got 9 people, if you've got 5 people plus Senator Kennedy receiving 9 bullets, you've got a problem.
Right.
And so then the next thing you got is when you make a schematic drawing, don't overlook the obvious. You can't make a bullet go up into the ceiling and come back down to a person's head and make it go upward. It's obvious it doesn't work that way. And yet, that's what they did. It's obvious that when you have bullets going into ceiling tiles, and you remove the ceiling tiles, and you take the ceiling tiles back to your laboratory, and you subject them to x-rays, you can tell by looking not only at the bullet hole with your eye, if you've got a good eye, but also with the x-rays, exactly what direction that bullet came from and how it went into the tile. You can also do tests upon it to find out what kind of metal was contained on the bullet that went through the tile. Was it gold? Was it lead? Was it zinc? Was it antimony? What was it? What kind of a bullet went through there? And what kind of bullets do you have that are in this gun, you know?
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan and Robert Scholing. Dr. Scholing, of course, was a lawyer. He was deeply involved in forensics and associated with the Forensic Society. And his comment is, look, you only have to look at the most obvious. First of all, there were 5 people hit plus 3 shots four shots actually. As far as Robert Kennedy is concerned, a 5 and 4 is 9. You don't get 9 bullets out of an 8-bullet gun. It just doesn't work that way. And then, of course, the direction the bullets, of course, it hit not only Senator Kennedy, but of course the one that actually hit one of the people and went through their forehead, supposedly bounced off the ceiling. These things just don't happen. And so obviously his point is, the obvious things tell you that the story we've been told suggests that this is not at all an open and shut case. Well, our telephone number is, of course, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you're out there in the listening audience and you have a question on this, but Mr. Joling's been working on this really for 40 years. I don't think he's not all time, but he's been really, I think, wanting eventually to write a book that would make it so simple. And I really believe it. It is so simple. And it's simple that the one thing you've proven it is not an open and shut case. And whatever we think about Saran, why, of course, it is possible, in fact, it is possible that he did not kill the senator. He obviously was involved in discharge of a gun that hit a number of other people. But should we try to find out what really happened, or should we just sit back and be unconcerned? Well, our telephone number again, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 464-8295, if you have a question on this case, because it is certainly one of the most important and significant cases of the last century, and as far as I'm concerned, it's still unsolved. Well, certainly, is there any a talk of, you mentioned that the Saran's lawyer had wanted to meet with you. Would there be any chance of having another trial or getting a retrial on this, do you think? Not necessarily to exonerate Saran, but to try to get the basis of what really happened?
Well, as a former judge and former trial lawyer, I could say, yes, there is a chance that that could happen. But if it does happen, I hope that they don't go into a re-examination and a rehash of all the old stories. I would appreciate it if they did a new examination using all the new data. And, of course, during the process, you're going to be looking at some of the old stuff. But it's the new data they should be looking at and work backward from that to what happened. And they'll find out if they do that, that they made the wrong conclusion back in 1968. Now, that doesn't mean that the Los Angeles Police Department is a bad police department, nor the people that are on the force are bad people. It just means that they had one incompetent and apparently very egotistical individual who was working this examination and screwed it up because he simply overlooked the obvious and couldn't believe what he saw and failed to confiscate, say, the second gun or the third gun and to see whether or not somebody else indeed had fired their gun, as one of the witnesses stated he had done. So when you do that, you're behind the eight ball. Now, if you don't have that gun or you're not going to use that person at trial and give him the option of appearing and not appearing, giving him the option of taking a live box or not taking a live box, where are you at? You had a totally incomplete, incompetent investigation.
Well, you know, I'm really surprised that the Los Angeles Police Department didn't immediately seal that off and seal everybody in there until they had all of the evidence and had all the pictures and you know, had taken statements from everybody who was there.
Well, after you saw what happened in the O.J. case, I don't know why you should be surprised.
All right, fine. Well, we've got Ray calling from Santa Cruz, and again, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Hey, Ray, how you doing? Did you have a question for our guest?
Yes, I don't know whether this would be relevant to the investigation, any investigation Kennedy's death, but it always dawned on me, it always occurred to me that both President, Senator Kennedy and Martin Luther King both spoke out very vociferously against the war, you know, in Vietnam, and they were killed, you know, very not too long after each other, you know, so I'm thinking that there's got to be something, there's got to be some kind of conspiracy involved here.
Well, of course, Ray, what Mr. Jolie and Mr. Van Prague are doing, they just bring out the facts. Certainly they're saying there may have been a conspiracy, there may not have been a conspiracy.
Yeah, there may not have been.
The thing is that they want to bring out the facts, because, of course, if you advocate a conspiracy, then they'll attack you for advocating a conspiracy.
Yeah,
if you stick with the facts. And certainly, my tendency, personally, is to agree with you, but that's not really what they've done. I think they very wisely decided not to tell you all the details of why they think it happened or who they may have done it, but simply the fact that it happened and it didn't happen the way we've been told. That's the significant thing. Anything else you want to say, Ray?
Well, you know, there was just some similarities.
Hold that thought right there. Hold that thought.
That's all.
All Hale, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest is Mr. Robert Joling, and of course we're talking about this whole issue of the murder execution, call it what you will, of Bobby Kennedy, of Senator Kennedy. You know, one of the things that was done at the time, there were a lot of explanations as to why Saran had carried out this heinous crime, and it was pointed out that he was a Palestinian. And, of course, that Senator Kennedy had been supportive of the Jews, so that's why the Palestinian would want to kill him. Now, suddenly, you know, that sounds like sort of a shallow excuse for a murder. Did you ever hear any of those stories that went out at that time?
Yeah, but the one about Kennedy supporting Israel and sending over the airplanes, that story appeared after Sirhan was accused of saying that statement. So what the truth of it is or isn't, I don't know. But it's really not germane to the whole issue anyway, because whatever reason he may have had to be there that evening, if he indeed, as the conspiracists would say, was hypnoprogrammed, then, of course, he cannot be guilty of the crime that they're, even another crime, let me put it that way. On the other hand, as far as we are concerned, there's no question in our mind that Sirhan was there, that he fired this gun. He fired it twice before he was put on the steam table, and he fired it six more times thereafter. So it is no question about that fact, or those facts, let me put it that way. And, of course, there's no question about the fact that Senator Kennedy got shot three times into his body, once into his clothing, and that Goldstein and Wiesel also got shot by bullets coming from the same direction. So you've got eight from one position, and you've got six bullets from another position. You've got 14 bullets that have got to be accounted for. And Phil Van Praagh and his wonderful engineering feat has shown that there are at least 13 gunshots that he could determine by the use of computerization of these waves of wavelength and oscillograms. And so he has actually wed his findings with my findings, and they support one another in that fashion. And the two of us never knew each other until a year ago when we were on the Discovery Times channel together, and when we saw that neither one of us were conspiratorially inclined, we started talking one to another and found out that our findings really wed one with the other. And that's when we decided to write our book, An Open and Shut Case.
All right, we'll hold that thought for just a moment here. We're going to bring all of our other stations back on board, and then, of course, we'll want to get the... Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Dr. Robert Joling, and, of course, Dr. Joling is even a little older than I am. That's getting pretty old. But he's been at this for a long time, and he's served as a judge, and certainly as a lawyer, and... But he's always been intrigued and wanted to get the true story of what really happened with the murder of Senator Robert Kennedy. Now, would you want to go ahead and get your website out one more time so people, if they wanted to go there, and of course they can order the book, an Open and Shut Case there, and they can also get some of the information that you and Mr. Van Praagh put up on the website. So what is the website, and is there a telephone number or anything, or just a website to go to?
We just leave it on a website, because otherwise our phone would be ringing off the wall more than it is now. The website is www.openshutcase.com, and openandshutcase.com.
And if I can, first for our listeners out there, make a suggestion, if you can't remember the title, I just go up on Google in Robert Joling, J-O-L-I-N-G, and the Google will eventually take you to their website. So it's nice if you can remember it. If you can't, that's the alternative, and that's how we were able to track Mr. Joling down. Anyway, of course, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295 if you have a question. I've heard some stories about Saran had said he was with some sort of a woman earlier in the evening, and that's sort of the last thing he remembers until he wakes up. Does he wake up in prison, in jail? What really happened as far as his story is concerned?
You're talking about the girl in the polka dot dress?
Right.
The girl in the polka dot dress was seen standing next to Sirhan by the tray stackers at the end of the ice machines. That was across the way, 6'3" between the ice machines and the steam tables. That's the distance Sirhan had to travel to get over by Euchre and fire at Senator Kennedy. There was a girl standing next to him in a black and white dress with black polka dots on it, a very attractive young brunette. And interesting, afterwards she was gone, and we saw her anymore. And when Sirhan was asked about this by his mother, he said that he didn't remember doing this act. However, when he was talked to by the psychiatrist who hypnotized him, he remembered being with a girl, and he mentioned that. But they asked him again then, well, what about the girl? And he just clammed up, said nothing more. So apparently, from what he said not only, but several witnesses, there was a girl standing next to him by the tree stacks before he went across that little 6'3" pathway over by the steam tables to fire at Kennedy's entourage. And people have often wondered about that girl. Now, nobody ever really located her, and the information that I have is that she died several years ago. She was murdered, and that's where that stands at the present time.
Well, I think, of course, it often happens when there are these strange cases. Some of the witnesses do end up getting murdered. If they're smart, they disappear because, of course, once you're involved in something like that, in case there really is a conspiracy, why, of course, you can never allow the truth to come out. Well, we've got Ed calling from Calgary in Canada, and Ed's certainly one of our, in fact, I just read a letter that Ed had sent us today. Hey, Ed, how are you doing?
Yes, Dr. Sam, very good to talk to you again. This Robert F. Kennedy case, if I may get to it again.
Sure, go ahead.
It fascinates me, and I do have a question for Dr. Scholling. Is he still there?
Dr. Scholling is right here, right.
Good evening, Dr. Scholling.
Good evening, Joe.
J-O-L-I-N-G.
I am sorry. I'm listening to it on the shortwave, and sometimes it's not too bad. Tonight it was really good. Anyway, if I may, please, I have a question. In these other cases here, like John F. Kennedy, Abraham Lincoln, Archduke Ferdinand, and even 9/11, the finger was always pointed at another identifiable group or a political entity. In the case of John F., you got Roosevelt's connection with the Cuban communists. Abraham Lincoln, of course, was assassinated by Booth or a Confederate rebel diehard. Archduke Ferdinand, it was a black hand, Serbian extremist, and 9/11, it was Osama bin Laden, etc. Now the question, I don't recall that the Robert F. Kennedy case pointed a finger at anybody. I have a question, what was Sirhan's stated motive, and was there a finger pointed at an identifiable group or political entity?
All right, Ms. Joyne, do you want to answer that?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. As far as we know, there was no political motivation in this whatsoever. There has been some talk about Sirhan being angry at the Kennedys because of their support with Israel, but that's more talk than proof. What motivated him to do this? Who knows? The conspiracy theorists believe that one of several people may have paid a psychiatrist in California to hypnoprogram Sirhan, and that he was there for the purpose of firing a gun. Whether it was to fire at Kennedy and kill him is another question. But whether it was a conspiracy between him and anyone else is open to question.
Well, my study in this sort of thing,
I don't get into that because, again, as I've stated before, it's not germane to our findings.
All right, fine. Ed, you want to make a point there? Go ahead.
Well, it's my studies that the Arabs invented assassination here way back there in the Crusades. You know, they'd brainwash certain people, and then they'd hype them up with hashish. Anyway, that's all I wanted to ask, and thanks a lot for the answer.
Thanks very much,
Ed. I might add to that, you know, there's a difference between murder and assassinations only because assassinations involve a political figure or a person of prominence. It's still murder.
And we just give you have the most incredible guest
because of the person involved.
Okay, thanks
very
much.
You have the most incredible guest. Have a good evening.
Good night, Ed. And that's Ed calling from Calgary in Canada. Our telephone number, of course, is 1-888-888-888. 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And I do appreciate Mr. Joling being willing to come and with us, especially for 2 hours. He's getting pretty late back there where he lives. But anyway, we've got about 20 minutes more. So if you're out there in the listening audience, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And, of course, this is certainly one of the most important crimes of the last century. And everybody, of course, thinks it's an open and shut case. But as you begin analyzing the information that's been brought out, and Mr. Joling very wisely doesn't speculate. Because when you speculate, then they'll try to undermine what you're saying. But if you simply look at the facts of the case, I mean, just simply, as they used to say on the wonderful program had to do with the Los Angeles detective, just the facts, ma'am, just the facts. And Sergeant Joe Friday, I think it was, who said that. But it was a wonderful line, and I think that this is what we need, is not to get all wound up in why did Saran do this, or what about the girl in the polka dot dress. They're fascinating things to conjecture on. But, of course, the basic facts are you don't get 14 shots or 13 shots out of an 8-shot gun, no matter how you, of course, try to distort our reality.
You know, this case raises very interesting questions for the legal profession, for the criminal justice system, for the political scientists, for the historians, for the sociologists, for the psychiatrists. If I was a professor in college, I'd have every one of my students in those types of classes reading things of this nature, and then analyzing them and say, what are the legal issues? What are the conspiratorial theories? Why should we care about this after 40 years? And what are the conclusions you can draw? And I'd have my students go out there for a whole year and do the study and come back and answer those questions.
Well, of course, from your point of view, what is the significance of this story 40 years later? So I think Saran's grown old in prison. He was obviously involved in the crime. He had his gun had shot a couple of people. He had tried to kill a presidential candidate. Why is this important, I hear, of course, in April of the year 2008?
Well, this is a carriage of justice of this nature. And it's been carried out by one of the largest and finest law enforcement agencies in the country. It really makes one become concerned that such a thing could happen just because somebody was incompetent or failed to do their job in a proper manner. In other words, if this can happen to a person of the prestige of Senator Kennedy and a presidential candidate, what can happen to just a common man who is arrested? And so are they just going to put anything together, go to court, make up the story, and whether you like it or not, that's the way it's going to go? Or are you really going to get justice because people, and I'm talking about the lawyers, defending you properly, and the courts making sure that the testimony that's given is presented properly by the prosecution, and that you get a proper defense, and that you do have your constitutional rights protected, and that you do have your right of appeal and have it maintained without destroying evidence and getting rid of things that could be there to give you exculpatory evidence in the end? What should be done when you get the question of how was the corpus delicti really proven in this case when you can't even compare the fatal bullet to the gun you're talking about? What about assistance of counsel? Was it proper? Was it right? Was it competent? What about spoliation? That means about the hiding of evidence by the prosecution. What about the failure to disclose exculpatory evidence? What about destruction of evidence? What about the veracity of witnesses? What about conjuring false evidence and schematics? Now, all of that looks like malfeasance or misfeasance of some kind. If that can happen in a case like Senator Kennedy, then it's no wonder that we have 280 or 90 people now off of death row because DNA says that they're not guilty because the people that testified against them falsified their testimony willfully or wrongfully. And then you say, why? Because we have to guard and protect the people who are not capable of understanding the methodologies that are used in the courtroom. Only those of us trained in that capacity can do that. And then we fail sometimes by not doing our job, such as in this case.
Well, I certainly appreciate the fact that you are dedicated to this whole concept of justice, because without justice, why, no man's life or family or property are safe. And of course, fortunately, there are some lawyers who've taken these cases, people on death row, and then, of course, using DNA evidence, have found that they they weren't guilty of the crimes. And it really has been wonderful to see these people actually released and allowed to go back to their lives, even though they may have spent 20 or 30 or even more years in a crime for which they did not commit.
And then the tragedy of that is, take a person like Soren, he's been in jail for 40 years. If he came out into our society today, could he adjust? Could he live in it? What if he was totally innocent, for example, if that was the fact? How could he come back and even fit into society anymore? Now, that's the tragedy of these things. It isn't just the fact that a man went to jail. You ruined his reputation, you ruined his family, you ruined his livelihood. You've done all kinds of things. And then when people say, well, so what? It's 20 years ago, it's 40 years ago. Well, I don't care if it's 10 minutes ago. When you do something wrong of that nature, the least you could do is admit it's wrong and correct it. And that's what justice should be doing.
I agree with you totally. In fact, I'm very, very concerned about what's happening to the justice system in our society. When you stop and think, we have 2.3 million people in prison, and actually 7 million Americans in prison, probation, or parole. In fact, if you look at simply the adults, one in every 32 Americans is in prison, probation, or parole of the adults we're talking about now. Something's wrong with the system when we see that happening. And even in communist China, they don't have that many people in prison, population, parole, and they've got liberty four times what we've got.
And we have the most severe penalties of any country in the world.
Amen to that.
People away for longer times than anybody else does.
Why do they do that, really? I mean, you as a lawyer, you as a judge, you as one who's seeking for justice. I mean, some of these prison sentences are just unbelievable.
I think it's the desire of some people to satisfy those who are out there screaming the loudest about putting them away forever or punishing this or punishing that. Now, there's a lot of people whom you cannot rehabilitate. But on the other hand, in our prison system, we aren't rehabilitating anybody. And that's the other tragedy of it. And then we have another problem, and the politicians will never, 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 never look at it. And they can say what you want, but when you have people coming into our country who already have committed criminal acts by coming into the country wrongfully, and the government will do nothing to enforce the law, what do you expect the people to look at the government and say? What the heck, I don't have to obey the law. I could get amnesty just by having millions do wrong. And that's not right. That's not justice. And I know there's no simple answer to it anymore, but we have let it go on and on and on without enforcing the laws that are there. And then that's the mistake we make.
Or at least
we have to be mean, but we do have to enforce the laws.
And of course, the thing is that we have very, very selective law enforcement. In other words, there's certain laws we force, and we over-enforce them, and other laws which should be enforced are not being enforced. And we have to ask ourselves why these things are happening, and these are the sort of questions we ask over and over again here at Radio Liberty. Well, if you're out there in the listening audience, we could probably take one more call. Our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you have a question for Mr. or Dr. Robert Joling, certainly he's been involved in this legal system for a long time, and you can tell with the passion that he speaks about how important justice is. And justice should be important to every single one of us, whether in the legal profession or not, and that's why people should not certainly try to avoid getting onto a jury. People need to be on juries. We need to have good people on juries, and we need to be sure that every person who is going to be sentenced for crime is really guilty of that crime, and we have to be able to be willing to sit there and carefully analyze exactly what's going on. It's amazing, Chris, the terrible and awesome responsibility people have sitting on a jury. Most people look upon this as something that's a bothersome requirement that's just going to disrupt their vacation or disrupt their job, disrupt their life for a time. But certainly, jury duty is an important part of being a citizen in a free society. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I have polled hundreds of juries, and I have talked to hundreds of jurors. And I think the most precious thing that any citizen can do is to sit on a jury and sit in judgment on somebody of his peers. It's the most awesome task that you can face. And when you do it honestly, Not with the idea, well, he's here anyway, he's going to be guilty because he's here. But I really believe that a man is considered innocent in the law until he's proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. That doesn't mean all doubt. That means reasonableness is applied. When there's a reasonable doubt, the man goes free. Doesn't mean necessarily even that he didn't commit that crime at that point. But when you just go out automatically and say, because he's here in front of us, he's been charged with a crime, therefore he's guilty, that is wrong.
Because that old adage, Corey, with the federal grand jury, you know, they say that you can indict a ham sandwich. I haven't quite
understood.
I don't know why they want to indict a ham sandwich, but I think it simply is...
Well, the grand juries, federal grand juries, have become, in some instances, a tool of the prosecuting attorney rather than a tool of the justice system where they go out for fairness.
We're going to hold that thought. We're going to be back here in just a minute to wrap up the program here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we've had an amazing time here with Mr. Robert Schilling, who, along with Mr. Philibin Prag, has written the book, An Open and Shut Case. We've got 3 minutes for you to wrap up the program. What's the message you would like to leave with our listeners tonight?
I don't have any specific message other than whenever you get into anything, the agenda should be truth. Do not engorge yourself in trying to make something bigger than it is, different than it is. Just tell it the way it is and let the facts fall where they are and let the people who read the facts make the judgment.
And, of course, you know, one of the things I see all the time is when people are talking about an issue and they've got so much information and they've got, you know, and they complicate and they bring in all these other issues, side issues. They're all very fascinating. But, of course, they detract from the simple facts, as Joe said. Sergeant Joe Friday, I haven't thought of Joe Friday for a long time, but, you know, just the facts, ma'am, just the facts.
Jack Webb.
Jack Webb, right. And, of course, you did a great job, Sydney, clarifying that, I think, as we talk about what happened. And all we have to do is the direction of the bullets, what the autopsy showed, and, of course, the number of shots that were fired. And, of course, when we have the forensic proof that there were 13 or 14 shots fired, there's no way in the world, of course, that could come from an 8-shot gun. And then, because we have to begin to question what happened. And, of course, we have to say, look, forget about what the media says, forget about what everybody else says. What are the facts that we know are true? And if these are true, then we certainly should continue our
investigation. Doctor, may I make a plug for an action that's going to be happening in California in June?
You certainly can.
John Judge from Washington, D.C., is the head of the Coalition on Political Assassinations. It's called COPA, C-O-P-A. And they are putting on a meeting on June 6th, 7th, and 8th, and Phil Van Prag and I will both be there doing a PowerPoint presentation on this matter. And if anybody wants to contact John, it's COPA, C-O-P-A, at starpower.net.
That's John at?
COPA, C-O-P-A,
right.
At starpower.net. His name is John Judge.
Starpower.com or .org?
.net.
Okay, fine.
And we will be there, and John can tell you what the.
Where is this going to be? In Sacramento? Going to be in San Francisco? Los Angeles.
Los Angeles.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Jolie. Really appreciate your being with us.
They could come down and call John and get there.
Thank you so very much for being with us. I'm going to let you go.
All right. Be sure you go out and read www.openandshutcase.com.
Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Mr. Choling said, be sure to go see Ann and openandshutcase.com. Don't forget the Ann. It's all one word, and openandshutcase.com, and you'll find it fascinating material. And, of course, their book will be out, hopefully, for mass distribution before long. I hope that they can get this book into a major distributor. In my experience, is so often books that tell the truth are simply well suppressed. We have a perfect example of that in the story of the murder of Martin Luther King. And of course, the book, first book that came out on Orders to Kill, you go up on Amazon, I think they have 3 or 4 copies of that, and they're ridiculously expensive. However, the second book on that, written by Mr. William Pepper, who is the lawyer who represented the King family in the trial, the federal trial, dealing with the murder of Martin Luther King, the execution of Martin Luther King. The book is called An Act of State. We actually have that. We actually have a four-tape set on that, of course, of interviews we did on the murder of Martin Luther King. And, of course, he was murdered, at least the jury found, as part of a government effort to execute him. He was assassinated by people involved at the highest level of our government. That's what the jury said. And the fact you haven't heard about this in the mass media is simply a reflection of the degree of control that today exists over what the American people think. Now, if you'd like to get the book, An Act of State, and or the four-tape set, or four-CD set for that matter, Who Executed Martin Luther King? Why, of course, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And then, of course, we do carry the book by our good friend Galen Ross, the Elite Serial Killers. It goes into the murder of Robert Kennedy. And much of what we've heard tonight is actually in that four-tape set. But, of course, I think that the book put out by Mr. Joling will be certainly much more thorough, because it will deal simply with this one murder, this one execution. But Galen Ross's book has JFK, RFK, MLK, and, of course, Abraham Lincoln, the Elite Serial Killers. Excellent book. We recommend it. And then, of course, we do have a four-tape set on the murder of President Kennedy. We have two of them. And I recommend the second one if you're only going to get one. We have an excellent DVD put out by our good friend Bob Fletcher, going into the murder of President Kennedy. And then, of course, we have the book, The Sniper Looks at Dealey Plaza, and, of course, Galen Ross's book. All this information available from Radio Liberty. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Now, if you're out there in the listening audience and you just say, well, I mean, what can I do about this? Well, what you can do is get other people to listen to our program and let me convince them the truth that most of what they think they know is not true. That the media in the United States is controlled. That we are not a democracy or a republic. That certainly our government had brought Fidel Castro to power knowing he was a communist. In fact, we're bringing communists to power all over the world. And Robert Mugabe, the communist thug who rules Zimbabwe today, was brought to power by the United States government. And in a similar manner, we financed communism since its inception. We can't let the American people know that. Let me simply suggest the pamphlet, The Communist Capitalist Alliance. If you read that one pamphlet and then, of course, get the references we have, it's quite obvious that, we financed communism since its inception. This whole idea that there was a battle between communism and capitalism is as phony as a $3 bill. The book written by Bill Clinton's mentor, Professor Carol Quigley, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, makes that very clear. Of course, there's another force out there. He refers to it as the Round Table. Of course, the Council on Foreign Relations is a front for the Round Table, but the Round Table was a front for the Association of Helpers, which was a front for the secret society that Cecil Rhodes created. You need to get Tragedy and Hope. So much. Go to our website and then pray for America. Please pray for Radio Liberty.
You're tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening.
afternoon, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, wherever you're situated on this great, big, beautiful blue globe floating through the void of Yah's creation. It is Tuesday, the 29th of April, 2008. For those of you that happened to catch Reverend Wright on CNN yesterday, maybe you too realized that the animosity many Americans feel towards this gentleman is because of the way the media has painted his picture. Now you find out what the other side of the story was, and guess what? A lot of folks are saying, wait a minute, that's not what they told us in the first place. No wonder CNN wants to change the subject. Where's your line in the sand? This is Dave.
And Joyce, and yes, Reverend Wright has become a household word, and I think the man is creating quite a sensation for a very good reason. I think the man is getting his message to the public, and they don't like it at all. A startling statement was made last night on Fox News that I want to share with you, and also the reaction from the news commentators to this man who is literally telling it like it is. Also, Lynn Horowitz, Dr. Lynn Horowitz's name was mentioned yesterday on the program, and he was called by CNN, and we'll have that clip for you also.